Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Myths are one of the key ingredients in caviar. Stripped of its shroud of legend and tradition, caviar would be just fish eggs. So writes Inga Saffron in her new book, Caviar, The Strange History and Uncertain Future of the World's Most Coveted Delicacy. And so it is that tiny silken beads from the belly of an ancient homely fish have made the centuries-long journey from pig feed to prized food. There was a time when sturgeon clogged the Delaware River and when caviar was also the name of a New Jersey town. But the real story of the other black gold begins, and some fear will end, in the divided territories of the Caspian Sea. Russia was the first to lay its claim to the delicate pearls, followed closely by Iran. But when the Soviet Union collapsed, so did Russia's caviar monopoly. Kazakhstan, Azerbaijan, and Turkmenistan cast their nets into the Caspian, and then came the poachers, flooding the worldwide caviar market with cheaper, sometimes lesser, stuff, and subjecting the regal treat to the rigors of supply and demand. Now, conservationists worry that an international caviar craving could mean the demise of the fish that predates the dinosaurs. Connection listeners, we're not taking any calls this hour. Your chance to turn up your radio, nurse your hangover, and enjoy. I'm joined from Philadelphia now by Inga Saffron. She is author of Caviar, The Strange History and Uncertain Future of the World's Most Coveted Delicacy. Hi, Inga.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. I guess we share something in that we both discovered the same thing as a new correspondent based in Moscow, that there's this perk of the job that nobody told us about before
there. That was one of the nice things. I had tasted caviar perhaps twice in my life before I arrived in Moscow. And then when I got there, it was everywhere. It was being sold in stores, on the street. There was even a guy who arrived at my door bearing caviar.
I remember the small blue tins, about the shape and size of a hockey puck, forgive me my Canadian imagery, but they went for about $5, and you could trade one for five or six packages of Marlboros, but you're right, they were a form of currency.
People, Russians who managed to get caviar would trade it for tickets to the Bolshoi, for favors. People who were well-connected used to get it in their Christmas food packages from the Kremlin. It was a delicacy, and it was a coveted one.
And the discovery that you describe in the prologue to your book, I'm going to ask you if you can turn to sort of halfway into your prologue, where you meet this fellow by the name of Magomed. Have I pronounced his name correctly?
That's right, Magomed. It's a version of Mohammed.
Okay.
Would you like me to read this part?
Just tell me what's happening before you start.
Yeah, well, when I first got there, I went to the local food store on the Orbat, and I would buy it in a jar. Sometimes I would have it at people's homes, at parties. But one day I got a call from a man who said that he had to see me right away. He was coming right over, and I said, sure, why not? Because, you know, being a Moscow correspondent, you were always being called by people who had stories and said they were spies or were just crackpots. So I said, sure, come over. And he arrived at the door. He was carrying these two very large, bulging shopping bags, and he didn't waste any time. He went straight into my office, and he pulled out of the bag this big blue tin. And at that time in Moscow, Russians were just discovering all these wonderful imported foods from the West, like Danish butter cookies. And I thought that's what it was. He was going to sell me some Danish butter cookies. But then he took off the lid, and there was this plateau of black eggs. And I couldn't believe it. I'd never seen that much caviar in my life.
Now, I want you to pick it up in the prologue from the part where it begins, "By then, my Russian assistants." Read us a little bit of your book.
"By then, my Russian assistant had wandered in to see what was going on and was stopped in her tracks by the view. Magomed urged us to try the caviar. We took some teaspoons and dug in. I rolled the eggs over my tongue, allowing the taut spheres to detonate a few at a time, hoping to harbor the taste for as long as possible. The salty, buttery richness filled my mouth, nuclear in its intensity. new and different tastes came in explosive bursts as the initial fishiness gave way to more complex flavors and aromas. I was reminded of other rich foods, olives, pine nuts, smoked salmon, but it was the physical sensation, the way the firm casings of the eggs gave way as they popped against my tongue and cheek that dominated the experience. What I realized was the caviar was something you experienced in your mouth, not your stomach. Compared to Magomed's caviar, the stuff I had been buying on the Arbat was junk, as bland and featureless as jelly.
That's almost a sexual description of the first taste of it. It
is a sensuous food. It's very much about texture, the way it feels in your mouth, the way it pops and explodes.
And what you're describing too, Inge, is also a peculiar, is one type of caviar. We should be clear about this. This was beluga caviar?
I don't think that was beluga.
Or wasn't beluga. Okay.
Magomed wasn't very clear on what exactly it was. It was probably a cetra. But, you know, I didn't ask any questions at that time. I mean, he just arrived with his caviar. It was very cheap. It was $125 for a kilo. It was an unbelievable price. And I bought it and didn't ask any questions and didn't ask them for a very long time. I didn't, you know, ask, why are you here at my door? You know, where did you get this caviar and why are you bringing it to me? And that only came later after I began to hear these stories about what was happening to the sturgeon in the Caspian Sea and the Black Sea and other places where sturgeon live.
Now, you and I will talk about our own sort of complicity in the demise of the sturgeon a little bit later, but I wonder if we can bring Armin Petrosian into the conversation. Now, Armin, of course, is a name that many people will associate almost immediately with caviar. He's on the line from Paris, president and chief executive officer of Petrosian S.A. Now, that's the company that owns Caviar Petrosian, Petrosian Inc., and Petrosian Restaurant in New York and Paris. Armin, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well. Now, I gather you two know each other.
Yes, we have met in Paris for a short time.
Now, let me hear from you the story of taking caviar to Paris, because I understand this is the Petrosian claim to really marking the food as an exotic food.
Yes, in fact, my father and uncle started the business in Paris in the 1920s when they opened the shop, and they were interested, in fact, in the food generally. And when they came to Paris, they didn't have any possibility to make their own studies, their own business, because they were, one was architect, the other one was a lawyer. So they couldn't apply their knowledge to France. So they thought about what they liked to do, and they liked the food, they liked the exclusive food, and they brought the caviar into the market. That's not to say that the caviar was not existing, but that was not available on the market, and that's what they have done. And they have brought this product as it is now, which is the luxury of the product. They brought the idea of luxury. They brought this product to his maximum. In Russia, it was a product which was certainly part of the zakouskis, one of the most exclusive part of the zakouskis, but that was not to say a very luxury item. And they brought that into the idea, because when you are buying caviar, you are buying also traveling to Caspian Sea, you are buying all the ideas about what is extraordinary in caviar, the sense of the caviar in your mouth, the sense of this extraordinary product, and how much it is exclusive.
Well, tell me how exclusive it is now, because I understand it's getting harder and harder to get the very best caviar.
Yes, that is perfectly true. It's difficult to find the best caviar. It's difficult to manage the caviar, and the situation is difficult generally. But let's put just the numbers together to say that In fact, there is a decline of the sturgeon in the Caspian Sea without any doubt. Everybody knows that, and there is no discussion about that. The discussion is to know how much is depleted and how much is the situation, where we are standing now. And I think now we have, since the CITES protection, 98, there is a tremendous growing of the sturgeon now, because the protection that we have now is really efficient. And I think it's not said enough that CITES, since CITES made all this regulation, that there is a very big improvement in the Caspian Sea.
We'll get into that a little later in the program. But while I have you on the line, Inga, I want to just get from you first the way that the Russians truly enjoy their finest caviar. Mm-hmm. How do they eat it, Inga?
Well, Russians would eat their caviar very simply. They might have some brown bread, a smear of butter, and some caviar, and just like that, maybe a little bit of parsley on it. They might eat it with blini. Traditionally, they've loved to eat caviar with blini, particularly at this holiday called Maslenitsa, which is sort of their Mardi Gras. And they would have it with butter or perhaps with sour cream and rolled up in a blini, and that would be a nice way to eat it.
Like a soft pancake. Now, Mr. Petrosian, yeah. Your favorite way of eating caviar, what's yours?
Well, for me, the best way to eat caviar is without nothing, nude, the caviar just in a spoon on your mouth, and have this sense, exclusive sense of the eggs in your palate running and rolling and popping, exploding. That is a very exclusive experience, and that is really the taste of the caviar, the sense of the caviar in your mouth. And that's fabulous, because this is the real, when you have the aftertaste which is coming, and you have really a very defined, specific taste to the caviar.
Now, you know that there are many other alternatives that are being mentioned, and we will talk more about those later in the program, but can any of them come close to what you're describing, the caviar from the Caspian?
Yes, for sure. You, for example, the American caviar or the French caviar, which are the farm caviar, they can be very good also, but also it's a question of selection, of maturation, and this is something which bring to the caviar. This caviar, if you want, they are actually close to the wild one, but not... I will say they are a complement offer, an additional offer. They are good by themselves. They are not as good as the wild, but they are good.
Mr. Petrosiano, I want to thank you for being with us on the program.
Thank you very much.
Armand Petrosian, President and Chief Executive Officer of Petrosian S.A., one name very well associated with the consumption of caviar. And Connection listeners, we will talk about the environmental issues as we move past our break and return with Inga Safran, who's author of Caviar, The Strange History and Uncertain Future of the World's Most Coveted Delicacy. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. The best of the new year to you. And in fact, if you had a chance to taste the best of any year, you may have had a little bit of caviar with your celebration the night before or last night. We are talking today with Inga Saffron, who is author of Caviar, the Strange History and Uncertain Future of the World's Most Coveted Delicacy. Inga worked as a correspondent in Moscow and had the great good fortune and good sense to spend some time in Astrakhan, studying the place where the industry really, I guess, in many ways, that was the beginning of the industry that Armin was talking about.
Yes, that's right. Astrakhan is located at the place where the Delaware spills into the Caspian Sea. Where the Volga River spills into the Caspian Sea. And so that was the place where fishermen worked, where they caught the sturgeon as they migrated upriver. And so the industry really began there. There had been fishing for sturgeon and caviar in other places in the Black Sea, in the Amur River, in other rivers in Siberia. But the Caspian is very rich, or was very rich, in sturgeon. There were more than 6 kinds of sturgeon living in the Caspian, and they were very plentiful. And every spring and every fall, they would leave the sea and they would begin to swim upriver.
How far back do we have to go, Inga, to a time when they were catching the sturgeon for the caviar rather than just catching it for the fish? Does this go back hundreds of years? Was it just a couple of hundred years ago?
Well, it's sort of hard to tell exactly when people first figured out how to make caviar, how to put salt on eggs and call it caviar. But people were probably fishing for sturgeon itself, you know, certainly 2,000 years ago, maybe 4,000 years ago. But we know that the Russian Orthodox Church mentions caviar as a food that could be eaten on meatless fast days. They mentioned that in the 12th century, so we know that Russian Orthodox Christians were probably eating caviar by that time, probably before that even. So it was a local food eaten, you know, by people who live near rivers where they could catch sturgeon and where they could make caviar from the roe. And only as improvements in transportation and preservation came about did caviar begin to be transported to other places beyond these rivers.
Now, I want you to tell me about your trip to Wolves Island, to the place where you got as close as you're ever going to get to the precious sort of caviar.
Yeah. I had wanted to see legal fishermen fishing for sturgeon. I wanted to see what that was like. And so I convinced a caviar dealer, a Russian caviar dealer, to let me go with one of his assistants. And we drove from Astrakhan across the steppe. And it's an amazing landscape. The Volga and its banks are very, very lush and green. It's like being in the Florida Everglades. Mm. But when you go inland a few hundred feet, suddenly you're in the steppe, which is a very arid plain. And we were driving through the steppe, and we saw camels, and we saw scrub, and we saw not much else. And it went on for a very long time, and the road ended, and we were driving over the desert, and it just, I thought, where is the river? Where is the sturgeon? And finally, you know, out of the blue, we were in the Delta, and it was like arriving in the Everglades. And we then had to take a boat through the Delta. The Delta is made up of lots of little islands and shifting pieces of ground and reeds. And we finally came to a bank of the Volga where the fishermen were working. And they were letting out their nets. The nets are quite big. They might be 400 yards across and 22 feet deep. And they're so big and they're so heavy when they're wet that they have to be wound around a spool, and a small tugboat takes the net and lets it out across the river. And this net is sort of like a floating fence. So as the fish are migrating up the river, they bump into this net and then get caught on their gills, or just caught in the traffic, and slowly this boat pulls in the net, and the fishermen help pull in the net. And
let me stop you there if I can, Inga, because that's a part of the book again which you've done a beautiful job of describing. Can I get you to flip your pages across to, I think it's page 23, right at the bottom?
Okay. With a final heave, the men bunched the net into a tight wad. Then, crouching slightly, as if they were raising a medicine ball, they emptied the twitching contents into a shallow boat. Nothing that had been in the river at that moment the net was drawn had escaped. When a few fish tried to jump over the sides of the boat, the fishermen grabbed them with their bare hands and tossed them back into the boat. The men hurriedly sorted the different varieties into crates, but no large sturgeon emerged out of the slimy heap. Veniamin was twitching as much as the fish, his eyes puffed with fury. This was worse, much worse than his boss Yevgeny had feared. Then Nikolai, the foreman, appeared from behind the boat, looking serious. He was swinging two slim stellets by the tails. Empties, he informed Veniamin. Whether they were male or female didn't matter, only that their bellies held no eggs. Without bothering to inspect them, Veniamin turned to walk away. His whole body vibrated in anger. He'd been wrong about the Russian sturgeon, and if that wasn't irritating enough, his men had not caught a single cow all afternoon. He would have to call Yevgeny with the news. Caron had used up two more sturgeon from its quota and had no caviar to show for it. Just then, the sound of laughter prompted Veniamin to turn around. Nikolai was standing ankle-deep in the water, trying to control a Russian sturgeon almost as big as himself. Its smooth belly glowed a brilliant china white in the afternoon light. On its underside, where its chin should be, a pair of large, fleshy lips opened and closed like a blinking eye. Except for those pathetic gasps for air, this powerfully built creature put up no resistance, as if it were already resigned to its fate. Just in case, a fisherman whacked the sturgeon hard on the head with a club. Its lips went slack, but it was only knocked out. Caron was now three fish closer to filling its quota. "It's with caviar," Veniamin shouted as he bent over the prostate fish. "You can see the curve in the belly near the genitals," he explained, now more animated than he had been the entire trip. "If the tail is narrow, the caviar is good. You press the belly. It's soft where the caviar is."
And the excitement that you hear in the men's voices shows in many ways how much money they can make. I mean, that one fish that you're describing could be worth thousands of dollars.
That's right. If there's 50 pounds or 100 pounds of caviar, well, they might sell it for $20 a pound. But by the time it reaches the shops of Petrosian or Caviar Terrier or another shop, it would sell for thousands of dollars.
Inga, when I was working myself as a correspondent there, I took my own trip to Astrakhan. It was at a time when the government factories were still working, albeit not at full speed, mm-hmm. but there were fish being brought in, the caviar was being processed and canned. Did you see any of that while you were there, or was that past?
It was just amazing because I had heard about this factory, Ruskaya Ikra, which was one of the main state packing plants.
That was the one?
In Astrakhan, and I had arranged from Moscow to visit them, and when I got there, it was a beautifully tended factory. A lot of Russian factories were completely falling down, but this one was pretty well kept, and there were flower beds, but there were no people, and we knocked, and nobody answered, and we sort of ventured in and went up the stairs and didn't find anybody, and we finally found the new director of this factory, who said that nothing was going on, and could we come back another day.
And this was in season. They should have been processing,
in season,
right?
At the height of the season, so there was no processing going on. And in fact, we overheard a conversation he was having where he said he wanted to grow tomatoes or eggplants instead of be in the caviar business because things were so bad. So he asked us to come back a day or two later, and we came back. And again, it was the same story, not a soul in sight. And we found him, and again, they weren't packing caviar, and this time he did send his he did ask his director to give us a tour of the factory, and we saw this fabled packing room, you know, where so much Russian caviar came from, and it was empty. There were some cans, you know, lying around. They had all this very fancy new equipment that they had imported from Italy for packing, but there was nothing to pack, and that was an amazing thing.
Is that, in your view or in the view of the experts, largely because of what happened after the collapse of the USSR with the growth in poaching?
I think that's part of the reason. When the Soviet Union was in business, you know, there was one owner, essentially, the state. And so there were very few packing factories. You just needed one in each region. After the Soviet Union broke up, this Soviet fishing business was broken up, and people bought boats and packing equipment from the state. And so there were many more producers by the time I got there. So perhaps that was one reason that this factory wasn't doing so well, that its producer wasn't doing so well. But yes, there were when the Soviet Union fell apart, so did its regulatory arm of its fishery, and suddenly all these people who lived in the delta and who had no work, there was one thing they could do, and they could fish for sturgeon, and they did that with a vengeance. And virtually every adult man in the Volga Delta is a poacher.
It's worth pointing out that the flesh of the sturgeon itself has value there. It's not just the eggs thereafter.
That's right. Yeah, Russians love sturgeon meat. It's a delicacy. They love it as much or maybe more than caviar. So even if you catch a male or you catch what's called an empty, which is a female that's already spawned or is too immature to have eggs, even if you catch that kind of fish, you can make some money selling the meat.
Have you eaten some of the sturgeon meat yourself?
Oh, yeah.
What do you think?
I like it very much. I think it's great. It's very meaty. It's solid. I like it cooked as a shish kebab. It turns a very nice golden color. It's delicious.
But is it also as rare as the caviar now?
Well, there's more of it per fish, but it's becoming rare also.
Right.
You know, the sturgeon, I would disagree with Mr. Petrosian. I don't think things are getting better in the Caspian. I think they're slowly getting worse, particularly for the beluga, but for the other species as well.
Oh, I tend to agree with you. Just in seeing the number of people who were poaching it, when I was there, we asked a couple of locals, where can we get some caviar? And they all steered us towards men sitting in battered old cars with their those large tins of caviar that you described at the beginning of the of this program, and they were quite happy to give it to
there
us.
There was poaching, you know, some poaching under the Soviet regime, but on a much smaller scale than there is now.
Well, tell us about Sasha, the poacher that you met, because I think in many ways it's revealing not only of what's happening to the industry, but what's happening to the quality of the caviar.
Well, Sasha was a young man. His father had worked for the State Fishing Collective, but by the time he was an adult, the Soviet Union had collapsed. There were no jobs. It's a very poor region of Russia. And, he knew how to fish, and there was nothing else to do. And so he got what's called a snost line, which is a long line with hooks strung along it like a curtain. And he would go at night to a particular spot that he thought was good for catching sturgeon, and he would put the line in, and he would leave the line there, and he would check the line and see if any sturgeon that had been migrating upriver had snagged on it. And if he caught one, and if it was a female, he would take it home at night under the cover of darkness. And he would, you know, maybe go home and make the caviar in his kitchen. He'd use water from the river to rinse the caviar. He would make it, and then the next day he would give it to a dealer who would sell it for him, or he would bring it to the big town and try to sell it, and he would make some money that way. And he wasn't the only one. Virtually every man in that town was doing the same thing.
But you make the point that that ikra, which is what the Russians call their caviar, is really, it just has to be handled and salted just so. You talk about the art of the ikryanchik, the person who salts the caviar, and that's what seems to be missing when the Sashas and the other people get into the business.
Yeah. In the Soviet period, ikryanchik was a specialized caviar maker. I mean, as specialized as someone who makes wine, and they would know exactly how much salt to put in the caviar. They would wash it in very sanitary conditions with very clean water. They would salt it with very clean salt. Poachers like Sasha, you know, they got the fish. They might cut it open on the bank of the Volga and take it out, put the roe in, you know, a bucket, any old bucket that they have. And a lot of people who live in that region don't have running water. It's pretty common not to have running water. Mm-hmm. So you would get your water from a well or the river, so it wouldn't be the best water. You would just have ordinary table salt. You wouldn't have special clean salt. So the quality of the caviar would be much lower because of the way that it was made. And a lot of people don't have refrigeration there as well, so they might leave it out until they were able to give it to their dealer. So might not be the most appetizing caviar in the world. But, you know, they got pretty good at it. And so they would sell it to a dealer who would sell it to another dealer who'd bring it to Moscow, like Magomed. And the very organized poachers, because then there was another level of almost like a gangs who would have boats and nets and a much bigger operation. And they could make pretty good caviar, and they could find a way to get it out of the country where they could make really big money.
Now, we'll be talking in a couple of minutes about the way that the sturgeon is seen as either endangered or not. We've got a couple of guests standing by. But before we do that, you write in the book about caviar New Jersey. Like,
that's
there
right.
was a place where caviar was popular and canned, and that's very little known, I think.
Yeah, it's amazing how quickly we forgot about this once very profitable industry that used to exist in the United States. But sturgeon exists not just in Russia, but throughout the Northern Hemisphere. There are quite a lot of varieties of sturgeon in North America, and every East Coast river, the Great Lakes, the St. Lawrence, the Mississippi, all the Pacific rivers all had sturgeon in them. When Europeans first arrived in North America, though, they thought this was quite a horrible beast, and they saw Indians eating sturgeon, and they thought, this is disgusting, this is barbaric, and they wanted nothing to do with it. So when fishermen, say, in the Delaware would be fishing for shad and they'd catch a sturgeon, they would just throw it away. They'd use it for fertilizer. They'd feed the roe to their pigs.
What happened to it, though? We hear so little about sturgeon in North America now.
Well, that's how it went for a while. And in the late 19th century, when Europeans developed a taste for caviar, they also had sturgeon in their rivers, and they very quickly fished them till there were none left. And so some German merchants who'd made a big business making caviar in Europe knew there were sturgeon in America. They came over here, and they saw these fishermen throwing away their sturgeon, and they said to them, well, we'll give you a dollar a fish, which was a lot of money, and,
right.
and the fishermen did. They made the caviar. There was a town in New Jersey called Caviar, part of Greenwich Township. And it was at the mouth of the Delaware, where the Delaware flows into the bay. And it was, again, like Astrakhan. It was exactly situated at the point when the sturgeon left the sea and began their migration to spawn up the river.
Inga, I'm going to have to stop you here. We'll pick it up when we come back after our break. Inga Saffron is my guest. Her book is Caviar, The Strange History and Uncertain Future of the World's Most Coveted Delicacy. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com. From Boston University, this...
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. We're back with Inga Saffron, author of Caviar, The Strange History and Uncertain Future of the World's Most Coveted Delicacy. And we'll be joined by a couple of guests in just a moment. Before we do, Inga, finish the story of what happened to Caviar, New Jersey.
Well, after the German merchants came and began buying these fish and making caviar and sending it back to Europe, fishermen in the U.S. saw how much money they were making, and they began to fish for sturgeon and to make caviar. And the thing about sturgeon is that it takes them a long time to reach maturity, to reach the point where they have eggs and they begin their migration to spawn. And they do spawn again, but if they're caught on their migration by fishermen, not only do you kill that fish, but you prevent it from having any babies, and you kill the future as well. And so it's very, very vulnerable fish. So once these American fishermen began fishing in the East Coast rivers, very, very quickly they began to decimate the population. And then the industry moved to the Great Lakes and to the Mississippi and Missouri rivers, and then to the West Coast rivers. And river by river, they destroyed the population in 3 decades. You know, they went from having rivers rich with sturgeon to populations that were so small it wasn't even worth fishing for them. So by 1900, by the early part of the 20th century, the sturgeon weren't even worth fishing for in the U.S. They were just gone.
Okay, we're going to talk about where we are right now. And we're joined by Eugene Lapointe, who's former Secretary General of the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora, better known as CITES. Welcome to the program.
Happy New Year to you.
Eugene, nice to have you here. Lisa Speer is also with us. She's Senior Policy Analyst for the Natural Resources Defense Council and spokeswoman for Caviar Emptor. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Happy New Year.
Now, Caviar Emptor is out to halt the international trade in beluga sturgeon completely. Is that right?
That's correct. You know, as Inga described, the history of sturgeon around the world is a history of serial depletion. And the Caspian situation is just the latest in a long string of overfishing and depletion that has afflicted this fish. And of the sturgeon in the Caspian Sea, beluga sturgeon, which produce beluga caviar, are in by far the worst shape. They've declined by more than 90% in the last decade. And a recent survey that took place last year by the Caspian Range States found only 28 sturgeon, beluga sturgeon, in the entire survey area. And most of those fish were immature. So we're facing a very serious problem.
Eugene Lapointe, do you agree that what's needed is a ban on the fishing for the beluga at this point?
Absolutely not. First of all, I think the science advanced by Lisa is completely out of the real science promoted by the surgeon specialist group of the IUCN, which is by far the most advanced body that can discuss properly about the science and sturgeons. And the problem with the ban, what the Caviar Emptor and NRDC are promoting, the ban on beluga caviar, will stop the legal trade. The problem is not the legal trade. The problem is the illegal trade. And the solution promoted by them will not be in any way address the fundamental issue of the illegal trade and its feeding pipeline, which is poaching. As we all know, poaching is created by poor social economic conditions in many countries, not only with sturgeons, but with other species as well. And I'd like to talk briefly about the Iran example here, which has not been discussed so far. In Iran, there is no poaching taking place. The caviar industry is feeding all kind of management program of scientific research, of reintroduction from the sea, and employing thousands and thousands of people, and all of that is fed by the illegal caviar coming out of Iran, which is something between 30 and 40 million a year. And this is the kind of model that we should be looking at in terms of conserving the sturgeon, the beluga sturgeon, and not looking at solutions which has absolutely nothing to do in addressing the problems.
Well, Lisa, what do you think about that? A ban that would just encourage the poachers and squash the legal industry?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, the U.S. government has proposed listing beluga sturgeon as an endangered species under the U.S. Endangered Species Act. And they did so based on a thorough assessment of the science that is available. And they concluded that, in fact, beluga is reaching the point where it may no longer be recoverable. So we need to act, and we need to act quickly. There are many things that have to happen in order for sturgeon to come back in the Caspian Sea. Habitat needs to be protected. Pollution needs to be reduced. There are a whole range of management improvements that are critically necessary. And, of course, enforcement is a critical issue. But unfortunately, those are all long-term solutions, and beluga does not have a long-term in front of it. That's why NRDC, along with our partner groups, CWEB and the Wildlife Conservation Society, have advocated for a complete ban on the export of beluga sturgeon. While that would give some breathing room and buy some time for some of these longer-term solutions to be implemented, while still allowing revenues to flow into the hatcheries that are really the only thing now standing between beluga and complete extinction.
So better enforcement, Eugene, perhaps to keep the poachers at bay.
Well, addressing the real issue, now I like to take back to some of the comments made by Lisa at this point. When she says that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has decided because it has been forced to do so by legal action taken by NRDC and others as well, and because the initial thinking was not to take at all this kind of action to list the sturgeon, the Bodega sturgeon, as endangered. But to work with the international community, like the CITES community, which has established control mechanism with quota allocation and so on, and work with the local governments in order to assure that the other problems that we are mentioning are taken care of, such as the poverty, such as the pollution, such as the incredible deterioration of the habitat that takes place in the Caspian Sea. Now, I don't see anything in what Lisa said that will address the issue with a ban again. The ban will do what? It will preclude the fact that we will have some money to be put on the conservation program like Iran does with its legal trade, in ascertaining that the Iran model will be copied by other countries of the Caspian Sea. It's a little better than it used to be in respect to Russia. But with the other three countries of the Caspian Sea, it's not doing any better. Now, I take strong objection to the kind of the style of the campaigns, if you want, to save a species. Not a single species had ever been saved by campaigns. Campaigns do have the effect of saving occasionally maybe one or two specimens of a species, but I'm not aware of any species which has been saved by campaigns. Best example of that is that the decade-long campaign by Greenpeace to save the whales have not given the result that the kerosene has done in saving the whales.
Now, let me just turn to Lisa. It doesn't sound like there's a lot of common ground here, Lisa.
No, and, you know, I think we certainly agree that international action is essential to restoring the fish, and we have pursued a variety of avenues in that direction. But the United States accounts for about 80% of the beluga caviar exported from the region, and as such, we are playing a major role in the depletion of beluga caviar. And as a result, we feel that it's critical for the United States to take action, and to take action quickly. And consumers can do their part by choosing better alternatives, more environmentally sound alternatives. Some of the alternatives that Mr. Petrosian discussed early on in the conversation, I think, are far better choices for those who are concerned about keeping this magnificent fish from going the way of the dinosaurs.
You're saying stick to paddlefish, for example, paddlefish roe or caviar.
Still, I don't understand, if you allow me, how you believe that stopping the legal trade will help the poaching activity. It will increase it.
Lisa?
Stopping legal trade will not help the conservation of the beluga sturgeon.
But Lisa's also saying that some real determined enforcement needs to be put in place at the same time. Wouldn't that go at least part of the way towards protecting the sturgeon?
And unfortunately, there's no easy fixes here. There are no quick fixes. There will be a very extensive program of habitat restoration, enforcement improvements, management that will be necessary. But again, these are things that are going to take some time, and beluga is spiraling downward so rapidly that we may not have that time. And so one thing we can do right now is to reduce the pressure on these fish. And one way to do that is to stop the legal trade. And, you know, in terms of the United States, a complete ban on beluga imports may actually help improve enforcement here, because it will be a lot easier just to stop the trade altogether.
Lisa, let me just go back to Eugene for one last comment, though. I mean, just to encourage consumers not to eat beluga caviar to give the fish some breathing space seems reasonable to me.
Absolutely. Well, are you saying that by telling people don't stop eating caviar, beluga caviar, you'll give a chance to the beluga sturgeon to recover? I don't think so.
Well, when you don't buy ivory, it gives the elephants a chance, doesn't it?
I was quite involved in that process, and I would not say that the notion of stop buying ivory saved the elephant has saved any elephant at all over Africa. It has helped in certain regions where there was two right. elephants left, or three or ten, but it has, on the other hand, destroyed some of the fantastic management program which were in action in the southern part of Africa. Going back to the sturgeon, the issue is here, how can we really address the problem of poaching? how can we stop the poaching? How can we get the money to change the poachers into people who are going to take care of the resource themselves? So that's the question. And again, what I'm saying, if you stop the legal trade, if you tell people don't eat any more beluga caviar of legal nature, you will save the sturgeon. Doesn't make any sense, because what you're doing, you're destroying a valuable source of income that will later on be turned into conservation mechanism for the local population.
You are both articulate spokespeople for different aspects of conservation, and I thank you both for being with us. Eugene Lapointe, former Secretary General on the Convention for, of the Convention on International Trade and Endangered Species, and Lisa Speer, Senior Policy Analyst for the Natural Resources Defense Council, spokeswoman for Caviar Emptor. And it would be almost as if, Inga Saffron, we've left you aside there. But this is a
very interesting discussion.
Well, you've heard this debate. You write about it in your book.
Yes, I have heard this debate, but not quite as passionately as it was just expressed. And it's a very tricky issue. You know, the CITES believes that if you maintain a trade in some species like caviar, that local people and local governments will have an incentive to protect that income from that industry. Mm-hmm. But it really, really hasn't happened the way people hoped in Russia and Kazakhstan. Because there's, after the Soviet Union broke up, there was very much a feeling of get it now before it's too late, before, you know, the communists come back or before there's nothing left.
So give me some guidance from your experience based on the debate that we're hearing there. I mean, I confess to being somewhat inclined towards what Lisa's saying, in that look for another type of caviar to eat.
Yeah, I'm pretty sympathetic to that as well, especially beluga, which is the most ancient of the sturgeon, the most sort of primitive in its habits. It takes the longest to mature. So that means it has the worst chances of survival. So, you know, we can set a zero quota now. We can always change it if its conditions improve. And historically, when there were wars or revolutions and people didn't fish as much in the Caspian, the populations came back.
And so you and I would both have to do without our beluga caviar.
We would. But, you know, for a few years it might be worth it if we'd get to eat it in 5 or 10 years. I could wait.
I think I could do. Inga, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Inga Saffron's author of Caviar, The Strange History and Uncertain Future of the World's Most Coveted Delicacy. We talked earlier with Armin Petrosi and Lisa Speer and Eugene Lapointe as well. Connection listeners, if you've some notions about caviar, you can find our website at www.theconnection.org and look for our forum pages there. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Direct Tire and Auto Service with locations in Watertown, Norwood, Peabody, and Natick. Information available at 1-800-TIRE-PRO or online at directtire.com. By Cahoots, marketing designers creating impact for corporate and institutional partners, specializing in naming companies and